Good evening, everyone. This is Spiritually Speaking with Reverend Jen and Rebecca, and it is January the 26th, 2015, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 7 p.m. Central, down to 5 p.m. Pacific Time. We're really excited to be on tonight. Unfortunately, as some of our shows are, we are taped. This show is taped. It's not live. So we won't have the call-in feature tonight, but we really encourage you, if you have a question or a comment as you listen to this, whether you're listening to it when it comes on the air on the 26th or you're listening to it in one of our archive versions, if you have any questions for Rebecca or myself or our guests tonight, please interact with us on our Facebook page. We do look at our Facebook page. We'd love to know your feedback and your thoughts and your comments. So you can like us on Facebook at Spiritually Speaking with Reverend Jen and Rebecca. And as I mentioned, I'm Reverend Jennifer Hope Kotler. I am a spiritual director and certified life and leadership coach in private practice, as well as an interim assistant pastor of missions and adult ministries at the Fox Valley Presbyterian Church in Geneva, Illinois. And you can say that. If you can say that three times fast, you're a better person than I am. And I'm here with my co-host, Rebecca Stevens, and I will let her introduce herself and our guest tonight.
Well, good evening, Jen. Thank you so much. I am really excited about our guest tonight. This is a person who we have maybe mentioned in every show that at least I have been a part of co-hosting. And I have just...
But no pressure, Emily.
Right. Yeah, no pressure. But I've just been in awe of Emily's ministry. I am a seminarian at Union Theological Seminary. I am also a musician here in New York City. And I came to New York almost 3 years ago with no job or no money, and really in a place of starting over. And through a series of very benevolent and wonderful events, I had the privilege of being introduced to Emily Scott as a gigging musician. And then, I don't know, like a couple weeks later, Emily was like, well, I'm kind of doing this other project in Brooklyn, so do you want my job? And I was like, yes. And so I have a really, really exciting vantage point that I get to watch Emily work. So Emily Scott is the founding and head pastor of St. Lydia's Dinner Church in Gowanus, which is in a little neighborhood in Brooklyn. And I'm going to let her talk more about, you know, where that is and what the community is like. But Emily, I would love to just welcome you. Thank you so much for being with us. And do you have anything you'd like to start off with?
Oh, wow. Well, just a big thank you to both of you for inviting me to be with you today. It's really nice, actually, to take a moment out to just talk with people who I like in my work.
Yeah.
So I'm very happy to be here and be chatting with you. And I find these kinds of conversations always help me kind of reflect on the work that I'm doing, and I learn something from them. So I'm looking forward to the opportunity to talk with you both about St. Lydia's and what we're up to right now, and what the world looks like for us as a congregation.
So for our audience, if you don't know what Dinner Church is, St. Lydia's is a worship service that happens every 2 weeks. And Emily, you jump in anytime you want to mm-hmm. elaborate or correct. But they meet twice a week, Sundays and Monday evenings, and there is a set liturgy, there is music, there is fellowship, and there is dinner. And I would say from my own experience just attending, you know, you walk in the door, you see some people, you speak, you help set up dinner, you know, and it's very much like a family situation where people are setting the table and, you know, tasting the sauce and, you know, making sure that everyone has a napkin and then it sort of goes into song and then into dinner and then Emily preach. So Emily, I'm interested, as, you know, and maybe our audience will be interested as to how you came up with this idea and why you thought that this was a good idea. And
I asked
what?
I ask myself that question often.
And,
well,
and
I want to know too. When did St. Lydia start, Emily? And how?
Okay, so maybe we need a little
kind of early history. Yeah,
we need a little history. Okay, great. Sounds good. So I'm going to get the years wrong because I'm really bad at remembering years. But St. Lydia's is about 5 years old now. And it started off. The idea for it sort of hit when I had moved to New York and was working at a. Working at a sort of larger church, planning their worship service, planning their liturgies. I was the director of worship. And I think I must have been 25 or 26 when I moved here. And I was just doing everything I could in the city to make friends with people, just kind of build my social connections and find people to hang out with and just build a life for myself in the city. And so in doing that, I went to a lot of parties and I hung out with as many people as I could and just tried to go to stuff and meet people. And the question always came up, of course, like, what do you do for a living? And I'd say, oh, you know, I live in a church. It felt like that. I work in a church. And so that, you know, of course, solicits a lot of different responses from people. Some of them are positive, some of them are negative. But I found that a lot of folks were curious about what I did and kind of interested, and they'd say things like, oh, you know, I've been looking for a spiritual community, but I haven't really found something that feels right. Or sometimes I heard people say something like, you know, I've tried going to churches in New York, but it's hard for me to get my foot in the door. And these are folks who are mostly younger, sort of in their 20s or maybe early 30s. And the more I heard that, the more I began to wonder if there was a sort of spiritual opening for a community that would help kind of create a place for the kind of people that I was meeting, some of whom were very, very new to spirituality in general and were just kind of beginning to feel a need for a spiritual life, and others of whom maybe had grown up in the church but had drifted away from it or had a bad experience or just hadn't come back to it for whatever reason. So that was kind of the spectrum of people that I was bumping into. And the idea of focusing a worship service for this kind of population around a shared meal sort of clicked together because I had also been doing a lot of hosting at my house and inviting people over to have a meal at my place, which is something that's pretty rare in New York. If you're living below a certain income level, a lot of folks, you know, the living quarters are very tight, apartments are very small, and a lot of people, A, don't really cook, and B, might not have a dining room table, so they might not have room for a dining room table in their apartment, and C, might live really far from their friends, and so inviting people over to your house if it's pretty far out in Queens or pretty far out in Brooklyn or up in Washington Heights can be hard. So people end up just meeting in restaurants in the city in Manhattan. So that's just kind of a cultural context that I was working with. So noticing that people responded so intensely to home-cooked food made me wonder, like, oh, you know, what would a spiritual community look like that feels sort of broadly open, but also rooted in this sort of very human pattern of sharing a meal together, which is something that is universal but is sacred across, like, any tradition that you can find, really, as right,
well as,
right.
You know, non-sacred traditions. And, yeah, that's intimate, I think, because I think another thing that can be hard in New York is that you feel anonymous a lot of the time. So creating a space where people feel known and seen. We wear name tags at St. Lydia's, so when you come in, people can remember what your name is or introduce themselves easily. There's all these little mechanisms in place to kind of help people connect with each other. With ease and sort of break down that sense of isolation in the city. So, and actually, as we've grown and kind of matured and developed, more and more of our mission has become focused around what I've been calling dispelling isolation. Everything we're doing beyond dinner church, beyond just the liturgy, is about kind of trying to connect people across boundaries, trying to sort of break down that isolation that can set in a city that's so big. You're kind of pushed up next to people all the time on the subway or on the street, but actually connecting with those people is something that doesn't happen as often as one might imagine in our world.
I had a professor this semester who said the human race's biggest fear is connection. And,
oh my gosh.
I see that so clearly in New York. So you have this concept and you start to develop it. And mm-hmm. I know through your journey that you were at the Zen Center in Brooklyn for a while. Were you at Trinity Lower East Side before that?
Yeah. So the progression, it took me kind of a while to figure out how to start. And there were also some questions that I had around even my authority to do such a thing, such an audacious thing as starting a church. I was not ordained at the time. And I had been raised Episcopalian. I was working as a layperson in a church that was United Church of Christ and American Baptist. Mm-hmm. So I was not really in a position. I didn't have a strong rooting in a denomination to sort of start a church. So there were a lot of questions that I asked about, whether this was the right thing for me to do, if I had the authority to do something like this, if it made sense. And what ended up happening is that I sort of surrounded myself with a group of Episcopal priests and some Lutheran pastors who sort of guided this whole process as it unfolded. So as the church kind of came into being, my call to ordination was also kind of under development. And so all those things kind of blossomed and flowered at the same time. So those first 2 years were actually really ambiguous in a lot of ways because we weren't connected to a denomination and I was not yet clear on my call. And we were this very small community that had started to gather. So there was a lot of discernment to do about, how to try and make this thing and do it responsibly. But we started off in the apartment of a friend of mine who's an Episcopal priest named Daniel Simons. He works at Trinity Wall Street. And he said, if you want to do this, like, I will be in it with you and I will preside and you can do it at my apartment. And so we had four services during Advent. I think it must have been 2008. And that was just kind of the pilot to see what would happen. And there were anywhere between 9 and 12 people there. And we just kind of, the form was actually very similar to what we do now. We cooked dinner, we prayed, we broke bread together, all these pieces that make up what we do at this point. And so we did that for 4 weeks, and at the end of it, I was like, so how is that? Like, should we do that again? And people said, yeah, I think we should. And it was already clear, Daniel has a pretty sizable apartment for New York, but his dining room table held 8 people, and we had already gone up to 12. So there was immediately a problem of space, which is always the problem in New York that you come up against, how to find space. So
it's definitely the final frontier in New York.
Space is the final frontier, it's true. So at that point, I had begun having some pretty serious conversations with a friend of mine named Rachel Pollack, who ended up being my collaborator and took on the first kind of paid position at St. Lydia's as our community coordinator, and she was a really critical piece of bringing the vision together. So she was kind of coming into the scene, and then the sort of most critical piece that happened when we were getting started is that I had taken to sort of wandering around different neighborhoods in the city, kind of imagining like where we would be and what it would look like and what kind of building we would be in, and just kind of, I don't know, I was just kind of like looking around to see what I could find. And in fact, like one day I was in the East Village and I wandered by this church called Trinity Lower East Side. And they're kind of a small brick building. They don't have a steeple or anything. They don't look like a traditional church. And they have a garden in the front. And the garden was filled with all of the guys who go to their soup kitchen. They have a soup kitchen every day that feeds 300 people. Oh. It's a really amazing program. And all the guys were just kind of hanging out in the garden and they looked really at home, and I was like, wow, this little church looks like they really have something going. It looks like they're really connected to these people. And so I poked my head in, and Trinity is so dedicated to its soup kitchen, in fact, that it has the community room where the soup kitchen takes place and the kitchen are on the first floor. It's the first thing that you see when you walk into the church.
Wow.
And then up on the second floor above that is their sanctuary, which is a very kind of modest square space that's not huge, and they have chairs, and you know, I kind of talked to the person who was at the door for the soup kitchen and asked her if I could poke my head up there, and she said yes, and I could just see it. I was like, wow, we could definitely bring tables up here and have worship in the sanctuary, or be, you know, downstairs in the community room, and they have this kitchen. And
nice.
So I literally cold called their pastor, Pastor Phil, and was just like, hi.
So brave.
I had no idea.
Wow.
He was extraordinarily gracious and said, why don't you send me a proposal? And so I wrote him a proposal, and, like, you know, a month later, Rachel and I were sitting in his office and having this really, really phenomenal conversation about the vision that we were having and how Trinity might support it. And they hosted us for the first 2 years of our existence for free.
Okay.
You know, we never paid rent. They gave us a little bit of office space. We had worship there every Sunday night. We used their kitchen. We broke a lot of their stuff by accident, and they were very gracious about it. They were very, very patient, and Pastor Phil ended up being a key mentor and really the person that, you know, that church sponsored me for ordination, and he guided me through that process. It was really sort of an amazing moment in my life.
Is that how you became Lutheran?
That's how I became Lutheran, yeah, because that church was Lutheran. So at that point, I started kind of wondering if that was the right denomination for me, and eventually landed on the understanding that it was. And then my ordination process unfolded with the Lutheran Church, the ELCA.
Wow.
Okay.
So you then moved to the Zen Center and found yourself, you know, I don't know, maybe growing out of that space. Mm-hmm. And so now you are in your own space, which to me is a very, very grown-up thing. In New York, to be like doing renovations and talking about HVAC and, you know, and like tile and shelving. And so now you have the space. And I have to say, from my own personal experience, it's beautiful. I mean, it's very intentionally beautiful, which I think is really wonderful, but it's not overstated in such a way that. It's just not an intimidating space. So,
so Emily, I have to ask, how did you get from there to where you are now?
From Trinity Lower East Side to where we are in our new storefront?
Yes.
Yeah, and maybe it would be helpful to just explain to your listeners, let me just do this chronologically. It's probably most helpful. So we grew out of Trinity Lower East Side, effectively, and Pastor Phil kind of said, it's time for you guys to take the next step, and we said, okay. So then we moved to Brooklyn, and we rented for a while at a place called the Brooklyn Zen Center, and we just rented by the night, so we would have to, you know, have all our materials for worship in boxes and pack them away at the end of the evening and take them out for each service, which is an experience that a lot of church planters have of being in kind of a temporary space. And then we began to kind of realize that in order for the church to really grow beyond just one service a week and, to take on new projects, like sort of really being rooted in a neighborhood and being connected to social justice and doing things like having Bible study and meetings and all these kinds of things, that we really needed our own space, not only because we needed a physical space to meet in to have these activities running, but also because we wanted to be connected to a neighborhood and really to kind of put our shingle out and say, this is where we are. Like, we're a physical presence here in this neighborhood. People can drop by. People know that we're here, which was really impossible as long as we were just renting by the night. You know, we didn't have a sign out, or there was no, like, visual presence, basically. Which really made us accessible only to people who were very connected on the web, which I had questions about because it disconnected us from anyone who doesn't have access to a computer regularly, which is a lot of people, actually.
Right.
So, So at that point, we started imagining the space that we wanted to move into and did a lot of work around figuring out what it would look like, how much we could spend, how much we could afford, what sort of neighborhood we wanted to be in, and subway access, all this kind of stuff. And, at that point, it sort of turned into a pretty traditional capital campaign. We started to kind of cast this vision with our donors, the people who support us, and raised, at this point, it's topped out at about $160,000, which I have never, I've never done anything like that before. That was a really new experience. So, and really, you know, I talked to a lot of people who had done something like this. I actually talked to the folks at the Zen Center because they had done a build out on their space, which we were now renting, and said, like, how did this happen? How do you do it? And the advice that I got over and over again was, you just have to do it. Like, I can tell you, they said, you know, I can tell you that it's going to be hard. You're going to feel really crazy. Everything's going to go a lot slower than you expect it to, despite your very, very best intentions. And also, you just have to go through it once in order to learn how to do it. And all that advice was absolutely right. Everything that they told me was true. So it was really a trial and error, and you learn along the way. Like, now I know a lot more about HVAC systems than I did a year ago.
You know, those really are the things they don't teach you in seminary.
Oh, they don't, no. They definitely
don't. They
don't
teach you how to run a capital campaign. They don't teach you about HVAC. Manageability.
Yeah, it's really a management job.
Yeah, there's a lot of management, and a ton of it is relationship development, I think. Like, communicating to people what it is we're trying to do, why we want to do it, and finding that reason that they think it's exciting enough to put some cash down behind it. And, you know, the people are so excited. They're so excited about what we're building. And, you know, we have folks around the country who follow us and see what we're doing on Facebook, and, like, having constant communication with them, sending them updates and pictures, and just making them feel like they're a part of this thing that's happening. Because they really are. They're completely integral to what we do. We couldn't do it without these donors. So just helping that reality to be really firm in their minds, like, you're really a part of this. We couldn't do this without you. And, like, look at this thing that you are making. So I think that's a big part of the challenge and the job, is to kind of figure out how to be really consistent about getting that message out there.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
you have the space, and you meet, you know, the worship services are two evenings a week, Sunday and Monday evening. Mm-hmm. And so what does the space do for the rest of the week?
Oh, great question. Yeah. So we're still building a lot of that and figuring out what that's going to look like. I think the congregation is really excited about the potential that the space has. The biggest piece that's come into place so far is that we are using the space during the week to launch what's called a co-working space. And a co-working space is a place where anyone who would normally work from home or a coffee shop, or anyone who's looking for an office or a place to work, comes and works together at a shared office. And a lot of it is about practicality, that working from home can sometimes be annoying, and you don't get a lot done, and there's lots of distractions and things like that. And some people just really need a place to work that's quiet and that sort of thing. But a huge piece of it is about being in community, and returns again to that idea about dispelling isolation in the city, that when you're working from home, or you're a freelancer, or you're a graphic designer, or whatever, you know, whatever thing you might do, you're alone for a lot of the day, and you can go the whole day without talking to anyone. Or you can go the whole day in your pajamas, or what have you. So what we're really envisioning is creating a space where people come together and they work alongside one another pretty discreetly, like everyone's kind of working on their own thing. But then there are these moments throughout the week of kind of touching base and of interaction. So we've begun having a shared lunch on Wednesday, where we actually always eat the leftovers from dinner church, which works out really well.
That's nice.
You know,
that's awesome.
Food. Yeah, it's really fun. So we heat up some nice food, and everybody gets around the table, and we just have lunch, and it's really lovely. I've been doing some little things where I go on a walk at, like, 3 o'clock. You know, I'll just write up on the chalkboard, like, 3 o'clock, walk around the block. And whoever wants to just, like, gets up and stretches their legs. And it's good for productivity. It's good for kind of resetting your brain. And it's also nice to just connect with other people. So right now we have, like, a small core group of coworkers who are working in the space. And I'm hoping to grow that to a community of probably 40 full-time coworkers, and then a group of part-time coworkers as well. And then as that group grows, we'll be able to add other things, like maybe we have silent meditation in the mornings, and maybe we have like little yoga breaks during the day. So all of that will be kind of in development. But the idea is to create a spiritually focused co-working space in Brooklyn that's broad enough for people who are religious and non-religious to participate in it.
Wow.
So really a kind of crossing, what am I trying to say? A place where a lot of different kinds of people can come together and do work and get to know each other.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I have to say, Emily, I've been, I hung up my shingle over almost 2 years ago now.
Mm-hmm.
As a spiritual director and a certified life and leadership coach. And I love the work that I do. Mm-hmm. And I love the clients that I work with. But so much of my work is actually not with my clients.
Yeah.
And so I have spent hours upon hours upon hours in my apartment, or my home, wherever my home happened to be, because, you know, at first it was in Manhattan, and we moved to Westchester, and now we're in Illinois. So,
yeah.
You know, my office moves, and fortunately, because of the nature of my work and the fact that I work primarily with folks over the phone or by Skype or FaceTime, I don't have to be in the same room with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so they can be anywhere in the country, and I can be anywhere in the country. And that's a blessing, but I don't have coworkers. You know,
yeah.
I don't have people that I see. So absolutely, I could go from the time when my husband left the house in the morning to when he came home at the end of the day, whether that, you know, and him being a pastor, whether that's at 4 o'clock or at 8 o'clock, completely dependent on the day, that I could go all day without seeing another person.
Oh, absolutely.
Or getting off the couch.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, going for a walk.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just in the second week of my new halftime position at the church. And one of the things that I think I'm enjoying the most is working with having colleagues again and working around other people.
Mm-hmm.
And the energy that you get from that and the, you know, just that collegiality of getting to work with other people. And I would see, you know, I love that the notion of, you know, one of the missions of St. Lydia's being dispelling isolation.
Mm-hmm.
Because,
yeah.
you know, here you are in a city of, I think when you count all the boroughs, it's 13 million people. And yet people are so isolated. They're in the midst of millions of other people, and yet they're
so we don't talk to each other
at the same time.
Yeah.
Right? No,
yeah.
God forbid.
Yeah. Well, and you know it's interesting too because co-working is definitely not an idea that St. Lydia's invented. It's we're picking up on a much much larger movement that's probably about 10 years old, and people are starting to come up with language around. What's being called the sharing economy, this idea that rather than having your own thing, you share that thing, like Zipcar and all these other kind of ideas that are popping
Airbnb
up. Airbnb. Airbnb, yeah, all of this. And then there's another concept called new mutualism, which kind of runs along the same lines.
What's it called, Emily? Say it again.
New mutualism. It's kind of hard to
new
say.
I have not heard of that.
Mutualism.
Oh,
yeah, and co-working,
so what is
I would
that?
Say,
exactly.
Well, you know, I'm not an expert on new mutualism. I was just reading a book about it, but I think it's really a word that describes like this move toward sharing things rather than a more individual way of life, that we're looking for something that's more communal as a culture.
Mm-hmm,
and then co-working in and of itself is really a movement, I would say. And it's based on the fact that a lot of folks are predicting that in a decade, 40% of the workforce in America are going to be independent workers, people who are working for themselves, because of these radical shifts that we're seeing in the way the economy is set up. And, you know, we have all these students who are graduating from college and they're not finding jobs in the workforce in the way that their parents did. And so they're having to make it up for themselves. They're starting their own businesses. They're designing apps. You know, they're freelancing from home. And so there's this tremendous shift that's happening, and a lot of things that you would get from the traditional workforce, like coworkers, people to work with, an office where you would go and run into people, support networks, benefits, all of these kinds of things are things
that come out of that.
Workers are having to create themselves. Yeah, so it's a really, it's an interesting time, and I think it's causing, what I've been noticing is that some of these freelancers who I've been meeting and young people who are starting businesses are actually thinking a lot about spirituality, because it takes a lot of spiritual and emotional grounding to do something that comes from your heart and that you're really going out on a limb to do. So, for instance, I led a workshop recently at an independent conference for independent workers, and it was called Riding the Monster Down, Terror and Self-Doubt in the Creative Process. and I got it's super heavy. And I got this solid group of, you know, mostly younger folks who are starting their own businesses or doing their own thing, and they are really battling some serious questions about, like, you know, all this stuff comes up. Like, why would anyone want to give money to this idea that I have? Or why am I doing this? Like, why don't I just get a regular job like everybody else? And that's
right.
You need a lot of support to battle through those questions and think through them. So I think there's a real spiritual need that's emerging. And these folks were very open to speaking spiritually about what they were experiencing, which I was really interested in, given the fact that we kind of have termed this like a secular age, you know?
Yeah. Well, and so how does it directly, because I know that St. Lydia's is really involved in the social justice movements that are happening not only in the city but around the country. Mm-hmm. And so how does co-working and sort of that, I don't want to say business aspect, but that sort of, you know, that part of your, you can term it however you're comfortable, but how does that translate or connect to or come about with social justice?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think St. Lydia's is exploring, we're getting deeper and deeper into justice issues as we get older. And I'm learning a lot about sort of how to position ourselves to do justice work that I think our congregation is really well equipped to do. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that our identity around justice issues is currently in formation, and of course will always be in formation. So one thing that's interesting about co-working is that, you know, we have these sort of different arms of what St. Lydia's is doing. We do dinner church. Now we're creating this other arm, which is co-working, which is actually generating some income for the church, which is great. And then we're also kind of developing this arm, which is kind of social justice and activism and education around social justice issues. So, for instance, we're doing a just reading series on racial inequality that's coming up in January, where everybody's been invited to read one of four works on racial inequality, and then we're going to come together and discuss them. So,
by the way, I just got the just reading pun. I've been seeing that on Facebook, and I'm like, that's kind of an interesting, like, it's not really an exciting title. But it's totally exciting.
You are
reading.
Funny, Rebecca. That's great.
Sorry, go ahead. Continue. I didn't mean to interrupt.
It's like a somewhat subtle pun.
Oh, my gosh, guys.
I'm so sorry. My phone just dropped because my cat jumped off of my lap. There we go. Everything's fine now. So I think one thing that's kind of fascinating about that is that, you know, all those readings are up on the chalkboard where the coworkers work. And, like, our Black Lives Matter poster is out on our front window, so all the coworkers see that when they come in. So there's some interesting resonance that I think will start to develop around the justice work that the church is doing and the coworkers' kind of potential to connect to that work if they would like to, that they might not otherwise be connected to because maybe they're not part of a religious community. So I guess what I'm saying is that there's a sense of overlap between the co-working and what's actually happening at the church. And I think that that's going to create, I don't really love the word synergy because it sounds kind of new agey, but for want of a better word, it'll create some synergy between these different branches of what St. Lydia's doing, if that makes sense.
So we might have some coworkers.
Yeah, no, for me, Emily, I mean, I think it's an exciting opportunity. First of all, I mean, you have people who are coming into a quote-unquote church that may or may not have ever, like, would ever darken the door of a church.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So, and they're also being exposed to a church that's not what they probably had in their head as this is what a church looks like, or this is what churches do. And so to sort of be able to break that mold for folks and say, well, you know, but you know, if they come to worship, you're a pretty, this is a traditional church. I mean, this is a church that has liturgy and worship and music. And, yeah, we serve dinner, but, you know, I mean, so I just find that really an exciting way to both address this sort of issue of isolation, but at the same time allowing people who wouldn't necessarily come to a church to experience what church is like in a different way.
And I think that's exactly what we're trying to do, is to kind of create almost like this middle ground. You know, and if you think architecturally about it, generally churches are places that are set apart architecturally, and they're for a pretty specific purpose, which is worship. So, you know, we have these big, especially in New York, these big sort of brick or stone sanctuaries, and they're set aside for this purpose, which is very discreet. And then we have this kind of like, there's a church and then there's a world, and we kind of come into the church and we go out into the world. And I think maybe one of the things that we're trying to do both architecturally and socially, if you will, is to kind of blur those lines between the church and the world, and the space that we've created is actually not set apart or set aside for the purpose of worship. It's been created for the purpose of living, basically, like working and living and eating and, you know, all of this stuff that's happening in there kind of overlapping on top of each other. So, you know, our church has become an office, and when your church becomes an office, the office becomes the church, which really connects, you know, the life that anyone is leading. I mean, what it tries to do is to say our whole lives are sacred. You come here and you work, and the work that you're doing is sacred, and you're doing it in a sacred place. And you're connecting to all of these other, you know, ideas and actions and, you know, this kind of organism that's being generated, I suppose you'd call it, if that makes sense.
Emily, one thing I want to lift up is that you are a master organizer. I mean, not organizer, yes, but I mean fundraiser. You're a master fundraiser.
Mm-hmm.
And something that, excuse me, people don't always understand about church leadership is that it's so much about fundraising. And I think I would think in your case, literally to keep the lights on. And so I would love for you to talk a little bit about your approach to fundraising. I've heard you say things like giving as a spiritual practice, that kind of thing. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's great. That's a great thing to think about. I think in terms of fundraising, it's sort of a constant spiritual goal for myself to keep myself grounded when it comes to money around the work that the church is doing. When I launched the church, I had this idea that was correct, actually, which is that if we have a vision, the money's going to follow the vision. And it was true. And I believe that it is true, that the first thing that you need is vision and a sense of focus, and that when that's in place, people get really excited and money kind of follows it. At the same time, the reality of experiencing that is often extremely stressful. You can kind of trust that that's the case and that's going to happen, but it doesn't mean that your bank account isn't going to be fluctuating wildly up and down. So I think that, you know, there's this constant balance between trying to find some sense of security financially for our church
and also saying, wow, you know, we didn't budget for that this year, but that would be such, it would be so amazing if we could, you know, pull off this, this interdisciplinary artistic show in the spring. Like, let's make that happen, and trusting that the money is going to come from it. And not only just trusting, but actually coming up with strategies to make sure that it does.
I think you're absolutely right, Emily, that, you know, people, you have to have a vision, and and that's key, that, you know, folks need, they want to give to a vision. They want to be a part of something that is vibrant and alive and exciting and has tons of potential. But they also very often need to be asked and need to be invited to give to the vision. You know, we often, I think that that folks get hung up in that asking part. Like,
for sure.
Oh, if I just, you know, if we just put this out there, you know, kind of the, if we build it, they will come. Well, no, they still need to be invited and brought in and enrolled to be a part.
And you have to talk about it all
the
time.
Division.
Oh, it's totally true.
Yeah.
If you don't ask people, they're not going to give. So just finding the sort of strength and grounding to say, you know, I'd love to invite you to give, to be a part of building St. Lydia's. And to find the language that, you know, works for you when you're doing that. But we talk about it every single week during announcements at St. Lydia's. We talk about giving. And then I think in terms of the congregation's giving, it's important, and I always have to remind myself of this, but it's important to continue to give them, like, different pieces of why giving is important for them spiritually and what it means, and unpack that. And there's all these different angles that you can take on what it means to give. So always kind of, that's just like a constant teaching that's happening, and it just takes a lot of maintenance and a lot of care and a lot of attention, I think.
You know, how do you deal with, I know that in your congregation you have folks who have a, you know, there's a socioeconomic, you know, there's a wide range socioeconomic abilities in your congregation. How do you navigate that as far as talking to folks about giving?
Yeah, you know, I we have a few folks in our congregation who have no income or are living on a fixed income. And one of the things that's nice about St. Lydia's is that everybody who comes to worship takes part in building it, because you can cook in the kitchen or you set up tables and put out forks and knives and everyone helps clean up afterwards. So even people who quite literally may have no money to give contribute. And I think that's really important because they, I think that they, it's a spiritual desire for them to give something as opposed to just receive. And I think it makes them feel really, really good to be able to give. It gives them agency to be able to give. I found
it's a need. I mean, we all need to be able to contribute.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's like the crux of it, because it's a spiritual need to give. It's like for our own spiritual health. So accepting those kind of extreme situations of homelessness or, you know, extreme poverty, I've found that even folks who are living on a pretty tenuous sort of, in a tenuous financial situation, really want to give. And for the same exact reason, like, they want to participate in what we're building, they want to be a part of it, and it's a spiritual gift for them to be able to give. So I almost never focus on amount. I don't think I've ever talked with our congregants about how much they're giving. I just focus on the practice. And, you know, some folks would argue with that and say that that's not appropriate. But I think at this stage in our development, that makes a lot of sense. And, so I think just focusing on that idea of, like, giving and giving regularly has been what we've been working on right now. And in the next couple of years, I'll probably start addressing with individuals
you know, I got some really good advice the other day, which was just write 10 notes to people before your campaign starts saying, you know, you've been giving so generously, and I'm wondering if you would be able to give a little more this year to help us reach this goal that we have. And I think that that's a really appropriate way to kind of nurture people's practices of giving in a congregation.
So one other thing about St. Lee is, in a particular place in New York and in Brooklyn, is that we live in this world of where things are sort of trendy and like what's hot right now. And I say this as a compliment that St. Lee is really hot right now.
That's funny to hear.
It's true. You know, it's really, you know, it's gotten a lot. You guys have got, I say it as, you know, as though it's like a monster, but you guys have gotten a lot of media attention, certainly with social justice actions that you've been taking part in. And, you know, folks like Nadia Bowles Weber sort of gave you a fist bump, you know, and I mean, just like, it's really just this wonderful build up that you have right now. And I would like to hear how you want to sustain it. And I don't think you're in a preventative mode of like keeping it from being something that it's not, but how do you see, you know, St. Lydia as being something that continues for years and years?
Yeah, that's great. Well, you know, it's an interesting question about publicity and sort of, what's the word? I don't know.
Media,
like kind of being in the public image or whatever
that
might be. I mean, I have pretty mixed feelings about it for different reasons. I guess one thing that I've been thinking a lot about lately is that we have some really great buzz in the church, like within the world of the church, and I'm very grateful for that, and I'm grateful that we've become a place that people are interested in, and some of the people come and visit us and want to learn about what we're doing. I think all of that's really exciting. And at the same time, there's something else that I would rather see. Like, what I'd love to see much more than having buzz in the church is having buzz outside the church. So it's pretty easy for us to get, you know, it's great for us to have an article in the Lutheran, or, you know, we got mentioned in Christian Century once, which was really exciting and cool. But I would really love to see us on, like, the other day we got listed in the Park Slope 100, which is like a blog of a local person who writes about 100 things that happened in this last calendar year that made Park Slope interesting or unique. And we got listed in that. And I was so excited. The thing that I'm most excited about is people who are not connected to church finding out about St. Lydia's. And if we're only circulating in church publications, it means that we're reaching people who already are involved in church. And I really want to be connecting with people who are not darkening the door of a church, not because I'm interested in converting them, but because I think there's people out there who really want to be part of something like what we're doing, and they haven't found us yet. And that's like my biggest goal is getting ourselves in front of those people, that audience. And it's a lot harder because it's hard to get secular media to talk about religion. And it's just a harder sell. And that's actually one of the reasons that the co-working space has been really great, because it's almost like a third thing that, you know, I can talk with people about the co-working space in a way that's easier and more open than talking with people about the church. We can place an ad for the co-working space in Brooklyn, which is like a Brooklyn blog, whereas I don't think they would let us place an ad for just St. Lydia's.
Right.
Now, do you have – I'm just curious, Emily, do you have a different name for the co-working space, or, you know, how do you talk about it with other people?
We thought about that. We thought about kind of making them two different identities, and I actually decided in the end that we really wanted it to be integrated, that what we're trying to pursue is like an integrated, holistic, spiritual life, and so we didn't want to kind of pretend that co-working was something different than St. Lydia's. So it's just called co-working at St. Lydia's, which is a little bit
not a very shiny name, but it's honest. And I think it's really honest about the fact that we are a church, and I think that's important to be upfront about who we are and not try and hide it or sort of like, you know,
mask it,
a creepy thing where people are like, oh, I didn't realize you were religious, or like, I didn't realize what I was giving my money to. Like, I really want to be honest about that. So, so I guess that's like really my goal is to always be reaching outside the circles that are closest to me and try and like get into those other worlds that I'm not connected to. So every time that happens, even in a small way, I get really, really happy and excited.
Well, and you had the HuffPost article last year, which was incredible.
The
Huffington Post, like,
mm-hmm.
article. Of course, it was on the religion page, but that was that was amazing, you know, to
that
get that
was.
Kind
And that was a piece of really spreading the word about fundraising was kind of the purpose of placing that article, but it was on the religion page. And, you know, now I'm thinking maybe I could write something about co-working and place it in the business page on Huffington Post. Like, that would be interesting. Or, now we're sort of exploring this idea of doing, like, an art show and a lecture series about neighborhood and gentrification in Gowanus, and that will allow us to tap into a whole other group of folks who are doing work around here and also, you know, garner the interest of people who are interested in those things. So always trying to figure out, like, how can we be doing something that's connecting to a different population than the one that's kind of already here, which is not to say we don't love the people who are already here, because we do.
Right. But no, that's a huge part of it. I want to just give some of the, like, the practical details about St. Lydia's. I don't know how many listeners we have here in New York City, but you are located in the Gowanus neighborhood in Brooklyn. What are the train stops that are around there?
You can take the F or the G or the R. Or even A, if you want to have a little walk.
and it's a nice neighborhood, really Brooklyn-y, which I like. And also, it's stlydias.org.
That's right.
stlydias.org, if people want to go and look. And, you know, there's pictures there and places to donate and to just sort of see the story of St. Lydia's. Also, Emily posts her sermons, which are magical, and I mean, they're just hearing you preach, Emily, is really a whole other, like, we'd have a whole other show about your preaching and preaching style, which I think is just wonderful.
Thank you.
So folks can go to that. Jen, I have not been paying attention to the time. I don't know if I feel like we've only been talking for about 10 minutes, but I always feel like
and you know, and we always say on every show that it's hard to believe that we have about 5 minutes left, and we have about 5 minutes left. it goes, that's the way these shows go. It's been really wonderful, Emily, to have you on the show and to be able to learn more about St. Lydia's and, you know, how it got started, what you're, you know. And I think the thing that has struck me over our time together tonight really has been about the way in which you are very intentional about connecting to place and looking at the community and saying, you know, how can we continue to reach out to folks in the community? How can we reach out to, you know, how can we really bloom and grow in this place where God has planted us, and what are the needs? And I'm also curious too, as an inside church person, you know, how many people are we talking? Like, how many people come to? I know you've got dinner now on two nights. So you meet on Sunday and Monday night, which you actually will be meeting while this is airing, and this is one of the reasons why we could never have Emily on the show live, because St. Lydia's meets on Monday night the same time that our show is on. So, I mean, how many people come to your worship service, and how would someone who's new, who hasn't been,
to St. Lydia's connect with that?
We've tried to keep the services from being huge. The reason we started a Monday night service and added it on was that we were reaching about 50 at our dinners, and it felt not very intimate. So we decided that 35 is about the sweet spot of when it feels really fun and like there's lots of people there, but it's not too overwhelming, and everybody feels seen. So we started the second service, uh-huh. and then both of those have been growing. So now I'd say after our move, you know, we get anywhere from 15 to 30. We haven't hit 30 for a while. So we've been a little bit smaller since the move because, you know, that transition takes a little bit of a toll. So uh-huh. anywhere from, like, mm-hmm. 15 to 25, I'd say, on an average night, which that's a pretty wide spread, but it can actually bounce up and down pretty considerably. Generally, like, 20 to 25, I'd say, would be the number. And then our core group of folks is around 45 people right now. So, yeah, it's this kind of moderately sized group of folks. And the way to connect in is just to show up. Just show up uh-huh. one night, and we'll give you a name tag and put you to work. And if you want to come, you can send me an email beforehand, and that's really helpful just so I can keep an eye out for you.
Yeah, if folks want to connect with you, do you want to give out your email address?
Sure, yeah. It's Emily@StLydias, STLYDIAS.org.
And also, I just want to mention, too, that if people want to bring groups, that it's mm-hmm. helpful to let you know so that there's enough food. But I will say that I've been at St. Lydia's on nights where there was a lot more people than expected, and food never seems to run out. And
it doesn't.
Somehow,
it's magical.
You know, it's amazing. That is one of the most amazing experiences to see that place just work.
Well, you know, and it is for us. I mean, we always trust that there will be enough. That whenever, you know, as Christians, that there is enough. And you know, in the story of Jesus telling the I always say, you know, it wasn't Jesus that fed the 5,000. Jesus told his disciples to feed them. So you know, you give them something to eat. So the disciples go and they start feeding people, and the food doesn't run out. And you know, it's an amazing thing as a Christian pastor who has seen this time and time and time again, when you have more people show up than you're expecting, and you might have just enough food, but you don't run out. Like nobody walks away from the table hungry. And so I think that's just that. I mean, in the just having that experience is so powerful and present. Not that we, you know, necessarily you want 100 people showing up when you're
all
expecting 15 all at once.
Right.
I am hoping that, you know, as you and your congregation continue to be faithful in blooming where you've been planted now in Gowanus, Brooklyn, that, you know, it's one of those things. It's just trusting that the people who need to find you will indeed find you.
Absolutely.
Certainly as your colleague and friend in ministry, that is certainly my prayer for you, that the folks who need to find you, either for co-working arrangements, and certainly for worship and spiritual nurture and feeding, will indeed find you.
Yeah. Amen. I'll pray that one with you. Thank you so much.
Emily, thank you so much for doing this.
Your
schedule is crazy, and of course trying to get Jen and I together to pre-record can be challenging too, but you are just so gracious to take time out for us, and we are so appreciative. Anybody that has questions, again, Jen mentioned it at the beginning of the show, but anybody who has questions, they can tweet me. I'm at A New Rebecca, A-N-E-W-R-E-B-E-C-C-A. You can tweet me questions. You can connect with us on Facebook.
And I encourage you to go to stlydias.org and give them lots of money because they're doing something really, 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 I use the word magical, but I think something really magical is happening there. So thank you so much.
Thank you both. Thank you, Rebecca.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
It's been our joy, truly. And so our next show will be on Monday, February the 9th. On Monday night, February the 9th, 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Central, 5 p.m. Pacific Time. Don't want to leave out Mountain Time there at 6. And we will be on live, and we'll look forward to talking to you then. Thanks again, Rebecca. Thanks, Emily. And God bless everyone. Good night.
Good night.